Hello, this is Sabrina Artel with Talk Universe. I'm excited to be speaking with royalty today. Hilary Carlip is the Queen of the Oddballs. Her third book, a memoir, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan, is published by HarperCollins. Hilary Carlip is an award-winning author, performance artist, web designer, screenwriter, and she even had an all-girl band, Angel in the Reruns, with a cult hit, Buffy Come Back. Hilary has won The Gong Show and so much, much more. It is my pleasure to introduce Hilary Carlip. Welcome to the show, Hilary.
Oh, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
Well, you have done so many things and so many fun and hysterically funny things and also so many deeply important things. When did you begin to identify as an oddball?
Well, I think early on, I always felt like I was different and like I just didn't belong. And I think rather than treat that as something to be ashamed of or afraid of or feel separate, I decided, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And I think the turning point was an incident when I got suspended from the third grade. Yeah.
Okay. Now, did this have anything to do with Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Exactly. You read the book.
Yes, I did.
I was imitating Holly Golightly, and I was smoking on the school playground. I had the gloves. I had everything but the long cigarette holder. And so I got into trouble. I was sent to a child psychologist. But a week later, I was picked out of everyone in my elementary school to appear on television on Art Linkletter's house party. So it was really kind of an affirmation, like, okay, it's an okay thing to be a little off center and to be an oddball.
And so this feeling of otherness or being on the outside, as you were just talking about, started quite young. And it seems like at a very young age, you're talking about being 8 years old now, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the third grade,
right,
that you began to embrace it. So what was this process then?
Well, I think it was subliminal at the time. Like, it wasn't even a conscious, like, here I go. But looking back, writing a memoir is an amazing tool for reflection and sort of helps you figure it all out. And there are other turning points throughout my lifetime that were big moments of the embracing of the oddballness, culminating in the final chapter of my book, which is about an appearance on Oprah that I was on for my first book. And that experience really led me to ultimately, you know, embrace being different and to not only accept it, but to celebrate it.
And the book you're referring to is Girl Power.
That's right.
And that book grew out of your work with at-risk teenagers in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
And so what is the connection then with that work you were doing in the book you wrote, Girl Power, with your own self-awareness and ability to accept yourself?
My work in so many different forms, from juggling and fire eating to my writing, has always, the material has a similar theme, which has been about really embracing self-expression. And Girl Power was all about encouraging teenage girls to express themselves. And for so long, with everything I've done, I also have a literary website called Fresh Yarn, devoted to personal essays, where I feature other people's work. I have been encouraging and supporting other people's work for so long, till the journey finally led me to realize, okay, it's time to tell my own stories.
Hilary, would you read for us a section of your book?
Sure, I can read just the beginning to that sets up this whole journey, really.
Great.
What do you do when you feel so invisible? You can't sleep without a light on, afraid that in the dark, you just might vanish entirely. Simple. Become someone interesting enough to be noticed. And that's exactly what I did when I was 8 years old. I took on different personas the way other kids tried on clothes. I frugged and mashed potatoed incessantly for an entire month when I was being a go-go dancer from Hullabaloo. After that, for several weeks, I yanked my short hair into pigtails, wore all black, and skulked around the house and school acting creepy, kooky, mysterious, and spooky when I was being Wednesday from the Addams Family. A few months later, hooked on Jerry and the Pacemakers, I sang and spoke only in an English accent. How much more interesting could I get? And it continues on.
A lot more interesting, it seems, having read your book, Queen of the Oddballs. So you were chosen to be on the Art Linkletter show. So what happened there?
Well, my child psychologist, who was quite a trip, it describes her thoroughly in the book, but she was very gnarled up with, I guess, arthritis. So she was this very freakish-looking woman, but like one of the only people who was completely interested in me. So I just loved her so much. And she kept encouraging me to be myself. So I tried that out on Art Linkletter when he started asking questions and completely blanked out and froze. And I had to call on another persona. And, of course, at that time, all my references were television shows. So the other persona I drew upon, Ellie Mae Clampett, from Beverly Hillbillies. And I answered the question with a big, thick Southern accent. And I think I was asked, what is my favorite thing that my mother cooks up? And it was something like critters or vittles. And I just cracked up Art Linkletter and, again, reaffirmed in my head that it was better for me to be someone else.
Better to be somebody else. Well, now, what is the connection between you growing up in Los Angeles? And your book is such a delightful journey. It begins in 1965 and takes us through 2004, and it's a journey through pop culture and also through Los Angeles and your life there. So what is that connection between growing up there?
I did grow up on the fringe of celebrity, and to me, especially in the guise of being someone else, it was a huge playground. So like when I was 14 and saw Carly Simon perform in concert, I just thought, I want to befriend her. And I did. And there's a piece about that in the book.
Is this all thanks to banana bread or?
Yeah.
Exactly. Or how would you describe it?
Well, the Troubadour where she played was a small intimate club, and they played 14 shows a week, 7 nights a week, 2 shows a night. So I went to every show, and I would go up to her dressing room, and she'd invite me and my friend Molly in, and we started baking her banana bread and other kinds of bread, and we became known for that with her. The story continues on about friends versus fans.
And yes, you write about that, about so much wanting to be considered Carly Simon's friend. And at a certain point, maybe you can share the story with us. You discover something else.
Yes, well, we thought we were friends, and we read an interview one day in a music magazine where she talked all about us, which was so exciting. And she just said, at the Troubadour, it's been great. There are these two girls there who just make every night there for me, and went on and on. And then it ended with, it's so nice to have such great fans. And when I read that, I was devastated. You know, I was 14 and devastated. So I wrote her a letter saying, I thought we were friends, and got back a beautiful letter from her that basically said, of course we are, but if I took the time to defend what reporters put in my mouth, I wouldn't have time to write any more songs or even clean my house. And the great thing that I'm really excited about in Queen of the Oddballs, I was able to include ephemera and different photographs and strange items, and one of the things is the handwritten letter from Carly Simon.
Yes, it's so fun in your book that you have all this memorabilia, and you've written the book, Hillary, in a very distinct style. So what was this choice that you made to incorporate all different kinds of writing in the book, and how you've divided the book up into sections which include a screenplay, letters, diary entries, things like that?
Well, I just thought I've had such an unconventional life, and I was writing about doing things differently. I thought, how can I write a book in a conventional manner? So when the chapter about when I sold my first screenplay to Columbia Studios and they cast Debbie Gibson as the lead, it just felt like, oh, it had to be told in a screenplay form. And there's another chapter about my experience of being on the movie Xanadu. Yes, a cult classic.
Yes.
And it just felt right to share this experience through a letter to Olivia Newton-John, who starred in the film. And there's also, you had mentioned my band. I had this all-girl, all-ex-con band. At least that's what we told everyone.
Yes, so Hillary, who was Angel?
Angel was a girl who was in prison, but, you know, she didn't murder anyone. It was for a minor offense, although she would never reveal what it was. And in prison, I, as Angel, the story goes, met up with these other girls and decided we found the light, but it wasn't through religion. It was through TV reruns. So we formed a band in jail. And
that is so Los Angeles, isn't it?
Right, TV reruns.
That's right.
But it really took off, and we had all these articles written about us, everyone believing we had met in prison. And the headlines were like, jailbirds turn songbirds and things like that. So that chapter's like a guide on how to be a rock star, or actually how to be an imposter. And,
well, and there is this fine line, isn't there, in these personas and in this creative expression, and that's the delight of the book as well, are these stories. You know, for instance, the King case. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So now today, a person trying to meet a celebrity would be called a stalker, right?
Absolutely.
But in your case, you were a kid. And tell us about this, about your summer project.
Well, it was after Carly Simon. I then saw Carole King open for James Taylor at the Trube. And another friend of mine and I decided we'd spend the summer befriending Carole King. And all the musicians lived in Laurel Canyon, so we decided to scour Laurel Canyon, and we called it the King case. And we gathered all sorts of clues. I had her license plate and her all her band members' addresses and phone numbers, and we'd knock on their doors and come in, make up excuses to come in and talk to them. And we really spent the whole summer. We did find her, and she did invite us in and not only serve us lemonade, but perform Lamaze breathing exercises on her kitchen floor in front of us.
Oh, my.
She was pregnant at the time. She was the hugest singer at the time. It was when Tapestry was at its peak. And there she was on her kitchen floor performing Lamaze breathing exercises.
And what year was this, Hillary?
1971, I believe.
Well, it really is an amazing journey through this history as well. You're mentioning the Troubadour, and there were some other incredible music clubs in Hollywood at that time.
Absolutely.
And then also, of course, you're also, as you say, writing about being on the fringes of celebrity. So these stories that you tell are all intertwined with this backdrop of Hollywood and what's happening there. In addition, you were very political.
Yes.
And what is this intersection that occurs between the performance side of yourself and what you're doing and then also the socially impactful side?
Good question. I think I just always, whether it was put into a certain, like called something, I've always been really committed to somehow making a difference, mm-hmm. whether it was through the political work or through creative expression of many sorts. So mm-hmm. I think that's what those have in common.
Right.
And strangely enough, I always ended up sort of in a weird spotlight. Like this one chapter called Teen Liver is about my high school women's consciousness raising group. And, you know, how many girls in the 70s probably were part of groups and things like that. But, of course, mine makes the L.A. Times. You know, we got all this press, which I love they called us teen libbers. And so there was something about being in L.A. and being out there and constantly in a weird little spotlight.
Yes.
So that was a connection, too, between the two.
Between the two. And what about what was happening with your father? He had leukemia. You write about this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is woven in between these other stories of your adventures.
Yes. Well, this is later on. As you had mentioned before, the book starts in the 60s and goes through, like, four decades. And in the late 90s, my father got leukemia. My father dying is one of the pieces.
And also you write about not wanting to give up a creative life as you felt that your father had. There was a part of him that was not expressed.
Absolutely. He had been an artist for many years and gave it all up and was very consumed with business. And while he was in the hospital, I found this book by Louise Hay, who had the metaphysical causation of illnesses. And I looked up leukemia, and it said, brutally killing inspiration. And it was just blew me away. And it really was one of those turning points that really affirmed to me that I just made a decision that I would never do that.
Well, from that, I'm going to leap to The Gong Show, which...
good segue.
Yes, it's not the smoothest segue, but you got... Well, first of all, you won The Gong Show.
Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
And you got a perfect score from Rex Reed.
I got the first 10 ever from Rex Reed.
So what did you do on The Gong Show?
How
did you end up on it?
I did a comedy juggling song, an original song, where the tricks were coordinated with the lyrics. And actually, I have the original clip from my Gong Show appearance up on my website, queenoftheoddballs.com.
And Hillary, I want you to know that I watched it.
Did you?
And
so there you see.
I practically fell off my chair in laughter, and so were all of the judges.
Oh, thank you.
You know, they were all laughing so hard. And this was, what would you call it, a musical theater piece, a song that you wrote with a feminist slant, right?
Kind of, yes.
And there you were on The Gong Show.
There I was, juggling away. And in the piece, as people can read, I, you know, got this perfect score of 30, and then suddenly I opened the dam on Rex Reed's generosity, and he gave someone else a 10, and she got a 30, and we tied. And then I won over her. But the brilliant thing, once again, on the fringes of celebrity, the person happened to be Cheryl Lynn, who went on to have this huge disco hit song, To Be Real. Do you remember that song?
Yes.
To Be Real, got to be real. That's who I tied with and beat. So it was crazy.
For me, I also grew up in Los Angeles, so I enjoyed this journey through these mm-hmm. decades and through these landmarks in Los Angeles.
Right.
And there is something very distinct about Los Angeles.
There is. And I've heard, it's so wonderful because I've heard that from people, but by the same token, I've heard from people who haven't lived in Los Angeles or even been here that they felt like they were taken to L.A. So they got to experience L.A. like they never had. One thing that just occurred to me, what I have done throughout the book is I start each chapter. Each chapter is in a certain year,
mm-hmm.
and I start each chapter with a front piece that is really these bulleted points of what happened that year politically, culturally, music, television, and personally, just kind of these one-liners all woven in.
Yes, I'm looking right now, summer 1972. I worked day and night at the McGovern for President headquarters, and then you go on and you speak of seeing Anne of the Thousand Days three times. And that's the other thing about it, is it's these journeys that are occurring in the book. And it's really a delight, too, because of your celebration of uniqueness. And I'm wondering, Hillary, what has the response been so far to this book of yours?
It's really been phenomenal. I mean, I really set out to tell my stories and hope to inspire people. But the reaction, I mean, like, has been extreme. Like, people have said, like, their lives have been changed just because they feel like they got permission to take a left turn or to do something unaccording to plan and let their oddballness thrive. And, boy, that just blows me away and just is thrilling.
And has your definition of oddball at all changed since the book has been published and you've been on a book tour with it and speaking to so many people?
Well, first of all, I've always had kind of the same sense. To me, it's kind of like someone creatively expressing themselves and being on the sunny side of weird, like just being a little off and doing things unaccording to plan.
Mm-hmm.
But on my tour, it's like now I'm an oddball magnet, and so many people come up
like to me. You weren't before.
All right. But so many people come up to me and tell me their oddball stories, which are amazing. And plus, at my readings, which are very different and involve juggling and many other things.
And fire eating.
Exactly. But I do this contest where I pass out cards in the beginning saying, have you done anything oddball in your life? Are you an oddball? Write it down. And then we narrow it down and have a vote, much like on the Gong Show, how the audience voted between me and Cheryl Lynn. And we pick the oddest things. And there have been some hysterical things.
Really?
Ah, but poignant ones, like a girl wrote, I buy up all the single bananas in the store because I don't want them to be lonely. So, you know, a whole range of oddballness.
So you're starting a movement of
Absolutely. Oddballs.
Well, Hillary, I want to thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
It's been great. So thank you so much. This is Sabrina Artel with Talk Universe. I've been speaking with Hillary Carliff about her memoir, Queen of the Oddballs, and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan, published by HarperCollins. We've been speaking from her home in Los Angeles.